restored my faith in the police," Roy's mother went on. "Honestly, I didn't know what to think after reading that outrageous story in the paper, the one about the policeman who'd had his windows painted black." It was Roy's impression that Officer Delenko suddenly looked queasy. "You all have a good night," he told the Eberharts, and turned the key in the ignition. "Do you happen to know that fellow?" Roy's mother asked innocently. "The one who fell asleep inside his car? What's going to happen to him? Will he be fired?" With a screech of rubber, Officer Delenko backed out of the driveway and drove off. "Maybe there was an emergency," Mrs. Eberhardt said, watching the patrol car's taillights disappear into the night. "Yeah," said Roy, smiling. "Maybe so."
8.
Roy stuck to his promise. He quit searching for Beatrice Leap's stepbrother, though it required all the willpower he could muster. One incentive to stay home was the weather. For 3 straight days it stormed. According to the television news, a tropical wave had stalled over southern Florida. 8 to 12 inches of precipitation was expected. Even if the sun had been shining gloriously, Roy wasn't going anywhere. The guy at the gas station reported that the punctured bicycle tire was beyond repair.
"You folks got a pet monkey?" he asked Roy's father. "Because I swear it looks like teeth marks in the sidewall."
Roy's parents didn't even ask Roy what had happened. Having lived in Montana, they were accustomed to dealing with flats. A new tire had been ordered, but in the meantime, Roy's bike sat idle in the garage. He spent the soggy afternoons working on homework projects and reading a cowboy novel. When he looked out the bedroom window, all he saw were puddles. He missed the mountains more than ever. When Roy's mother picked him up after class on Thursday, she said she had some good news. "Your suspension from the bus has been lifted." Roy wasn't exactly ready to turn cartwheels. "Why? What happened?" "I guess Miss Hennepin reconsidered the situation." "How come? Did you call her or something?" "Actually, I've spoken to her a number of times," his mother acknowledged. "It was a fairness issue, honey. It wasn't right that you got suspended while nothing happened to the boy who started the fight."
"It wasn't a fight, Mom."
"Regardless, it looks like Miss Hennepin came around to our point of view. Starting tomorrow morning, you're back on the bus."
"Yippee," thought Roy. "Thanks a bunch, Mom."
He suspected she had another motive for pestering the vice principal. She was eager to resume her early morning yoga sessions at the community college, which she couldn't attend as long as she was driving Roy to Trace Middle. He didn't want to be selfish, though. He couldn't depend on his parents forever. Maybe the other kids in the bus wouldn't make a big deal out of his return.
"What's the matter, honey? I thought you'd be glad to get back on your regular routine."
"I am, Mom."
"Tomorrow is as good a day as any," Roy thought. "Might as well get it over with."
Leroy Brannett, the bald man who called himself Curly, was under too much pressure. His eyelids twitched from lack of sleep, and all day long he perspired like an Arkansas hog. Supervising a construction job was a large responsibility, and every morning brought new obstacles and headaches. Thanks to the mystery intruders, the Pancake House project already was 2 weeks behind schedule. Delays cost money, and the big shots at the Mother Paula's Corporation weren't happy. Curly expected to be fired if anything else went wrong. He'd been told as much by a top-level executive of Mother Paula's. The man's job title was Vice President for Corporate Relations, and his name was Chuck Muckle, which Curly thought would be more suitable for a circus clown. Chuck Muckle wasn't a very jolly fellow, though, especially after seeing the newspaper article about the police car being spray-painted on Mother Paula's property. Among Chuck Muckle's responsibilities was to keep Mother Paula's valuable brand name out of the media, unless the company was opening a new franchise or introducing a new menu item, such as its sensational key lime flapjacks. In all his years of supervising construction, Curly had never gotten a phone call like the one he received from Chuck Muckle after the newspaper story appeared. He'd never before been chewed out for 15 minutes nonstop by a company vice president.
"Hey, it ain't my fault," Curly had finally interjected. "I ain't the one fell asleep on the job. It was the cop."
Chuck Muckle instructed him to quit whining and take it like a man.
"You're the foreman, aren't you, Mr. Brannett?"
Yeah, but...
Well, you're going to be an unemployed foreman if anything like this happens again. Mother Paula's is a publicly traded company with a global reputation to protect. This is not the sort of attention that's beneficial to our image. Do you understand?
I do, Curly had said, though he hadn't.
Serious pancake eaters wouldn't care what happened to the police car, or even about the gators and the portable potties. By the time the restaurant opened, all that weird stuff would be forgotten. However, Chuck Muckle had been in no mood for reasonable discussion.
Listen closely, Mr. Brannett. This nonsense is going to stop. As soon as we hang up, you're going to go out and rent the biggest, most bloodthirsty attack dogs you can find. Rottweilers are the best, but Dobermans will do.
Yes, sir.
Is the site even cleared yet?
It's raining, Curly had said. It's supposed to keep on raining all week. He figured Chuck Muckle would find a way to blame him for the weather, too.
Unbelievable, the vice president grumbled.
No more delays, you hear me? No more.
The plan was to get the site cleared before bringing in the VIPs and the media for the official gala groundbreaking ceremony. The highlight was going to be a special appearance by the woman who portrayed Mother Paula in the advertisements and TV spots. Her name was Kimberly Lou Dixon, a runner-up in the Miss America contest in either 1987 or 1988. Afterwards, she became an actress, though Curly couldn't recall seeing her anywhere except in the Pancake House commercials. They dressed her up in a calico apron, a gray wig, and granny glasses to make her look like an old lady.
Let me explain why you'll be out of a job if this project gets stalled again, Chuck Muckle said to Curly. Miss Dixon's window of availability is extremely limited. She's due to start filming a major motion picture in a couple of weeks.
No kidding? What's it called?
Curly and his wife were avid movie fans.
Mutant Invaders from Jupiter 7, said Chuck Muckle.
The problem is this, Mr. Brannett. If the groundbreaking gets postponed, Miss Kimberly Lou Dixon won't be able to attend. She'll be on her way to Las Cruces, New Mexico, preparing for her role as Queen of the Mutant Grasshoppers.
Wow, thought Curly. She's playing the Queen? Without Miss Dixon's presence, we will no longer have a blockbuster event, publicity-wise. She's the company icon, Mr. Brannett. She's our Aunt Jemima, our Betty Crocker, our Tony the Tiger, said Curly.
I'm glad you understand what's at stake here.
I sure do, Mr. Muckle.
Excellent. If everything goes smoothly, you and I will never need to speak to each other again. Won't that be nice?
Yes, sir,
Curly agreed. The first order of business was erecting a chain-link fence around the construction site. Finding somebody to work in the rain wasn't easy, but Curly eventually hooked up with an outfit in Bonita Springs. Now the fence was finished, and it was only a matter of waiting for the guard dog trainer to arrive. Curly was somewhat nervous. He wasn't really a dog person. In fact, he and his wife had never owned a pet, unless you count a stray cat that occasionally slept under the back porch. The cat didn't even have a name, which was fine by Curly. He had enough to worry about with the humans in his life. At 4:30, a red truck with a camper top drove up to the trailer. Curly pulled a yellow poncho over his glistening head and stepped out into the endless drizzle. The trainer was a beefy, mustached man who introduced himself as Callow. He spoke with a foreign accent, the same accent that the German soldiers always had in World War II movies. Curly could hear the dogs barking ferociously in the camper bed, heaving themselves against the truck's tailgate. Callow said, "You go home now, yeah?" Curly glanced at his wristwatch and nodded.
"I lock up the fence. I come back tomorrow early to get the dogs."
"Fine by me," Curly said.
"Something happens, you call right away. No touch the dogs,"
Callow warned.
"No talk to them. No feed them. Important, yeah?"
"Oh, yeah."
Curly was more than happy to steer clear of the brutes. He backed his pickup off the lot and got out to close the gate. Callow waved amiably, then he turned the attack dogs loose. They were extremely large, all Rottweilers. They took off loping along the fence, crashing through the puddles. When they got to the gate, all four of them leapt upright against the fence, snarling and snapping at Curly on the other side. Callow ran up, shouting commands in German. Instantly, the Rottweilers ceased barking and dropped to sitting positions, their black ears pricking up intently.
"Maybe best you go now," Callow said to Curly.
They got names? Oh, yeah. That one there is Max, that one Klaus, that one Carl. And that big one is Pookie Face.
Pookie Face? Curly said.
He's my precious baby. I brought him all the way from Munich.
They'll be okay in the rain?
Callow grinned.
They be okay even in hurricane. You go home now, don't worry. The dogs, they take care of your problem.
As he walked back to his truck, Curly saw that the Rottweilers were watching every move he made. They were panting lightly, and their muzzles were flecked with foamy spittle. Curly figured he finally might get a decent night's sleep. The Vandals didn't stand a chance against 500-odd pounds of badass dog flesh. They'd have to be insane to jump the fence, Curly thought, totally out of their minds. The next morning, Roy's mother offered to drop him at the bus on her way to yoga class. Roy said no thanks. The rain had finally let up, and he felt like walking. A fresh breeze was blowing in off the bay, and the tangy salt air tasted good. Seagulls circled overhead, while two ospreys piped at each other in a nest on top of a concrete utility pole. On the ground at the base of the pole were bleached fragments of mullet skeletons that had been picked clean and discarded by the birds. Roy paused to study the fish bones. Then he stepped back and peered up at the ospreys, whose heads were barely visible over the scraggle of the nest. He could tell that one was larger than the other, a mother probably, teaching her fledgling how to hunt. In Montana, ospreys lived in the cottonwoods all along the big rivers, where they dived on trout and whitefish. Roy had been pleasantly surprised to find that Florida had ospreys, too. It was remarkable that the same species of bird was able to thrive in two places so far apart and so completely different. If they can do it, Roy thought, maybe I can, too. He hung around watching the nest for so long that he almost missed the school bus. He had to jog the last block to get there before it pulled away, and he was the last to board. The other kids grew strangely quiet as Roy made his way down the aisle. When he sat down, the girl in the window seat quickly stood up and moved to another row. Roy got a bad feeling, but he didn't want to turn around to see if he was right. He hunkered down and pretended to read his comic book. He heard kids whispering in the seat behind him, followed by a hasty gathering of books and backpacks. In a flash, they were gone, and Roy sensed a larger presence, skulking. "Hi, Dana," he said, twisting slowly in his seat.
"Hey, cowgirl."
After a week, Dana Matherson's nose was still slightly purple and puffy, though it definitely wasn't protruding from the center of his forehead, as Garrett had claimed. The only thing startling about Dana's appearance was a fat, scabrous upper lip that hadn't been that way when Roy dropped off the letter at Dana's front door. Roy wondered if Dana's mother had popped him in the kisser. The new injury endowed the big oaf with a disconcerting lisp.
"You and me got some business to settle, Eberhardt."
"What business?" Roy said. "I gave you an apology. That makes us even." Dana clamped a moist, ham-sized hand over Roy's face.
"We're a long way from even, you and me."
Roy couldn't speak because his mouth was covered, not that he had much to say. He glared out from between Dana's pudgy fingers, which reeked of cigarettes.
"You're gonna be sorry you ever messed with me," Dana growled. "I'm gonna be your worst nightmare."
The school bus rolled to a sudden halt. Dana quickly let go of Roy's face and folded his hands primly in case the driver was looking in the mirror. Three kids from Roy's grade got on the bus and, upon spotting Dana, wisely scrambled for seats up front. As soon as the bus started moving, Dana again grabbed for Roy, who calmly slapped his arm away. Dana rocked back, staring at him in disbelief.
"Didn't you even read the letter?" Roy asked. "Everything will be cool as long as you leave me alone."
"Did you just hit me? Did you hit my arm?"
"So sue me," Roy said.
Dana's eyes widened.
"What did you say?"
"I say you need to get your hearing checked, partner, along with your IQ." Roy wasn't sure what possessed him to wise off to such a violent kid. He didn't particularly enjoy getting roughed up, but the alternative was to cower and beg, which he couldn't lower himself to do. Every time the Eberharts moved from one town to another, Roy encountered a whole new set of bullies and goons. He considered himself an expert on the breed. If he stood his ground, they usually backed down or looked for someone else to hassle. Insulting them, however, could be risky. Roy noticed a couple of Dana's meathead pals watching the scene from the back of the bus. That meant Dana would feel obligated to demonstrate what a tough hombre he was. "Hit me," said Roy.
"What?"
"Go ahead, get it out of your system.
You're a nutcase, Eberhardt.
And you're as dumb as a bucket of mud, Matherson." That one did the trick. Dana lunged across the seat and whacked Roy on the side of the head. After straightening himself, Roy said, "There, feel better now?"
"Damn right I do," Dana exclaimed.
"Good." Roy turned around and opened his comic book. Dana smacked him again. Roy toppled sideways on the seat. Dana laughed cruelly and shouted something to his buddies. Roy sat up right away. His head really hurt, but he didn't want anyone to know. Nonchalantly, he picked his comic book off the floor and placed it on his lap. This time, Dana hit him with the other hand, equally fat and damp. As Roy went down, he let out an involuntary cry, which was drowned by the loud, gaseous hissing of bus brakes. For one hopeful moment, Roy thought the driver had seen what was happening and was pulling off the road to intervene. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. The driver was as oblivious to Dana's bad behavior as ever. The school bus had merely arrived at the next stop. While another line of kids boarded, Dana composed himself as if he were a model citizen. Roy looked down, fixing his eyes on the comic book. He knew the assault would resume as soon as the bus got rolling, and he braced grimly for Dana's next blow. But it never came. For blocks and blocks, Roy sat as rigid as a fence post, waiting to be knocked down once more. Finally, his curiosity got the best of him, and he peeked over his left shoulder. Roy could hardly believe it. Dana was slumped sourly against the window. The dumb goon's fun had been spoiled by one of the kids from the last bus stop, who had been brave enough to sit right next to him. "What are you staring at?" the newcomer snapped at Roy. Despite his pounding headache, Roy had to smile. "Hi, Beatrice," he said. 9. School was nerve-wracking. Every time Roy entered one of his classrooms, the other kids stopped what they were doing and stared. It was as if they were surprised to see he was still alive, with all limbs intact. After leaving algebra class, Roy heard a stupendous phony farting noise behind him in the hallway. Garrett. He took Roy by the shirt sleeve and led him into a bathroom.
"You look sick. You should go home early," Garrett advised.
"I feel fine," Roy said, which wasn't true. He still had a headache from the thumping Dana had given him on the bus ride.
"Dude, listen to me," Garrett said. "I don't care how you think you feel. You're sick. Really sick, okay? You need to call your mom and go home."
"What have you heard?"
"He'll be waiting after seventh period."
"So let him wait," Roy said. Garrett tugged Roy into one of the toilet stalls and locked it from the inside.
"This is so lame," said Roy.
Garrett touched a finger to his lips.
"I know a guy in Dana's PE class," he whispered excitedly. "He says Dana's gonna snatch you before you get on the bus home."
"And do what?"
"Duh."
"Right here at school? How?" Roy asked.
"Bro, I wouldn't hang around to find out. Hey, you never told me you busted him in the chops, too."
"That wasn't me. Sorry." Roy unlocked the toilet stall and gently nudged his friend out.
"So what are you gonna do?"
Garrett called over the top of the door. "Take a pee?"
"No, I'm talking about you-know-who."
"I'll think of something." But what? Even if Roy managed to elude Dana Matherson this afternoon, the drama would start all over again Monday. Dana would resume the stalking, and Roy would have to dream up another escape plan. And that's how it would be every single day until school let out in June. Roy had other options, none particularly appealing. If he reported Dana to Miss Hennepin, she'd do nothing more than summon him to her office for a stern lecture, which Dana would laugh off. Who could take seriously a vice principal with one gnarly hair sprouting out of her lip? If Roy told his parents about the Dana situation, they might be alarmed enough to withdraw him from Trace Middle. Then he would end up getting bused to some private school, where he'd be forced to wear the same dorky uniform every day and, according to Garrett, learn Latin. A third alternative was for Roy to try apologizing to Dana again, this time oozing remorse and sincerity. Not only would that be groveling, it probably wouldn't achieve the desired effect. Dana would still hassle him without mercy. His final option was to stand and fight. Roy was a practical boy. He knew the odds were overwhelmingly against him. He had quickness and brains on his side, but Dana was big enough to crush him like a grape. Roy remembered the time he and his father had talked about fighting. "It's important to stand up for what's right," Mr. Eberhardt had said. "But sometimes there's a fine line between courage and stupidity." Roy suspected that fighting Dana Matherson fell into the second category. While he disliked the prospect of getting beaten to a pulp, what worried him even more was the effect it would have on his mother. He was very conscious of being an only child, and he knew his mother would be devastated if something bad happened to him. Roy had almost had a little sister, though he wasn't supposed to know about it. His mother carried the baby for 5 months, and then one night she got terribly sick, and an ambulance rushed her to the hospital. When she came home a few days later, the baby wasn't there anymore, and nobody really explained why. Roy was only 4 years old at the time, and his parents were so upset that he was afraid to ask questions. A few years later, an older cousin told him what a miscarriage was and confided that Roy's mother had lost a baby girl. Ever since then, he tried not to give his parents extra reasons to worry about him. Whether on horseback, bike, or snowboard, he refrained from doing some of the wild daredevil stunts that boys his age usually tried. Not because he feared for his safety, but because he felt it was his solemn duty as an only child. Yet there he was this morning, on the school bus, insulting the same pea-brained thug who already held a mortal grudge against him. Sometimes Roy didn't understand what came over him. Sometimes he was too proud for his own good. The last class of the day was American history. After the bell, Roy waited for the other students to file out ahead of him. Then, cautiously, he peeked into the hall. No sign of Dana Matherson.
"Roy, is something wrong?"
It was Mr. Ryan, the history teacher, standing behind him.
"No, everything's fine," Roy said breezily, stepping out of the classroom.
Mr. Ryan closed the door behind them.
"You going home, too?" Roy asked.
"I wish. I've got to grade papers."
Roy didn't know Mr. Ryan very well, but he walked with him all the way to the faculty lounge. Roy made small talk and tried to act casual while constantly checking behind him to see if Dana was lurking. Mr. Ryan had played football in college, and since then he hadn't gotten any smaller, so Roy felt fairly safe. It was almost as good as walking with his dad.
"You taking the bus home?" Mr. Ryan asked.
"Sure,"
Roy said. "But isn't the pickup on the other side of school?"
"Oh, I'm just getting some exercise."
When they reached the door of the faculty lounge, Mr. Ryan said, "Don't forget the quiz on Monday."
"Right, War of 1812, said Roy. "I'm ready."
"Yeah? Who won the Battle of Lake Erie?"
"Commodore Perry."
"Which one? Matthew or Oliver?"
Roy took a guess.
"Matthew?"
Mr. Ryan winked.
"Study a little more," he said, "but have a good weekend."
Then Roy was alone in the hall. It was amazing how rapidly schools emptied after the final bell, as if someone pulled a plug under a giant whirlpool. Roy listened closely for footsteps, sneaking footsteps, but heard only the tick, tick, tick of the clock mounted above the door to the science lab. Roy observed that he had exactly 4 minutes to reach the bus pickup zone. He wasn't worried, though, because he'd already mapped a shortcut through the gym. His plan was to be among the very last to board his bus. That way he could grab one of the empty seats up front and jump off quickly at his stop. Dana and his cronies customarily occupied the back rows and seldom bothered the kid sitting up near the driver. Not that Mr. Kesey would ever notice, Roy thought. He jogged to the end of the hallway and turned right, heading for the double doors that marked the back entrance of the gymnasium. He almost made it, too.
Let's be crystal clear about this, Mr. Brannett. You didn't report it to the police?
No, sir,
Curly said emphatically into the telephone. So there shouldn't be any paperwork, correct?
No possible way for this latest travesty to end up in the press.
Not that I can figure, Mr. Muckle. For Curly, it had been another long, discouraging day. The sun had finally broken through the clouds, but after that it was all downhill. The construction site remained uncleared, the earth-moving equipment sitting idle. Curly had stalled as long as possible before phoning Mother Paula's corporate headquarters.
Is this your idea of a sick joke? Chuck Muckle had snarled.
It ain't no joke.
Tell me again, Mr. Brannett. Every miserable detail.
So Curly had to repeat everything, beginning from when he'd arrived at the site early that morning. The first sign of trouble had been Callow waving a tattered red umbrella and chasing his four attack dogs along the inside perimeter of the fence. He was shrieking hysterically in German. Not wishing to be mauled by the dogs or gored by the umbrella, Curly had remained outside the gate, watching in puzzlement. A Coconut Cove police cruiser had pulled up to investigate. Officer Delinko, the same cop who dozed off while guarding the construction site. It was because of him that the spray painting fiasco had made the newspaper and gotten Curly into hot water with the Mother Paula's company.
I was on my way to the station when I saw the commotion, Officer Delinko had said, raising his voice over the barking of the Rottweilers. What's wrong with those dogs?
Nothing, Curly had told him. It's just a training exercise.
The cop had bought it and driven away, much to Curly's relief. Once the Rottweilers were secured on leashes, Callow had hustled them into the camper truck and locked the tailgate. Furiously, he turned toward Curly and jabbed the umbrella in midair.
You try and kill my dogs!
The foreman had raised his palms.
What are you talking about?
Callow had thrown open the gate and stomped up to Curly, who was wondering if he should pick up a rock for self-defense. Callow was drenched with sweat, the veins in his neck bulging.
Snakes!
He had spit out the word.
What snakes? Yeah, you know what snakes! The place is crawling with them! Poison ones!
Here, Callow had wiggled one of his pinky fingers.
Poison snakes with shiny tails!
No offense, but you're nutty as a fruitcake. Curly never once had seen a snake on the Mother Paula's site, and he would have remembered if he had. Snakes gave him the willies.
Nuts, you say?
Callow had seized him under one arm and led him to the portable trailer that served as Curly's office. There, coiled comfortably on the second step, was a thick, mottled specimen that Curly recognized as a cottonmouth water moccasin, common in southern Florida. Callow was right. It was seriously poisonous, and its tail was sparkly. Curly had found himself backing up.
I think you're getting carried away, he said to Callow. Yeah, you think?
The dog trainer then hauled him toward the fence to point out another moccasin, then another, and still another. Nine in all. Curly had been flabbergasted.
What you think now? Think Callow is Nazi fruit bar?
I can't explain it, Curly had admitted shakily.
Maybe all this rain brought him out of the swamp. Yeah, sure. Listen, you listen. Each dog is worth $3,000. That is $12,000 barking here in the truck. What happens dog gets bit by snake? Dog dies, yeah? I didn't know about no snakes, I swear. It's miracle, the dogs they all okay. Pookie face, the snake come after him this close.
Callow had indicated a distance of about a yard.
I take umbrella and push him away.
It was just about then that Callow had accidentally stepped in an owl burrow and twisted his ankle. Rejecting Curly's offer of assistance, the dog trainer had hopped on one leg back to the camper truck.
I go now. Don't ever call me again, he had fumed. Look, I said I was sorry. How much do I owe you? Two bills I send. One for the dogs, one for my leg. Oh, come on. Okay, maybe not. Maybe I talk to lawyer instead.
Callow's pale eyes had been gleaming.
Maybe I cannot any longer train dogs. My leg hurts so much. Maybe I go on, what you say, disability.
For Pete's sake.
Mother Paula's is very big company. Has lots of money, yeah?
After Callow had roared away, Curly carefully made his way to the trailer. The cottonmouth was no longer sunning on the steps, but Curly didn't take any chances. He set up a stepladder and hoisted himself through a window. Fortunately, he saved the phone number of the reptile wrangler who had successfully removed the alligators from the toilets. The guy was tied up on an iguana call, but his secretary promised he'd come to the construction site as soon as possible. Curly had holed up in the trailer for almost 3 hours until the reptile wrangler pulled up to the gate. Armed only with a pillowcase and a modified 5-iron, the guy had methodically scoured the Pancake House property in search of sparkle-tailed water moccasins. Incredibly, he found none.
"That ain't possible!" Curly had exclaimed. "They were all over the place this morning."
The reptile wrangler had shrugged.
"Snakes can be unpredictable. Who knows where they went?"
"That's not what I want to hear."
"You sure they were moccasins? I never saw one with a shiny tail."
"Thanks for all your help,"
Curly had said snidely and slammed the trailer door. Now it was he who was on the receiving end of peevish sarcasm.
"Maybe you can train the snakes to guard the property," Chuck Muckle was saying, "since the dogs didn't work out."
"It ain't so funny."
"You got that right, Mr. Brannett. It's not funny at all."
"Them cottonmouths can kill a person," Curly said.
"Really? Can they kill a bulldozer, too?"
"Well, probably not."
"Then what are you waiting for?"
Curly sighed.
"Yes, sir. First thing Monday morning."
"Music to my ears," Chuck Muckle said. The janitorial closet smelled pungently of bleach and cleaning solvents. Inside, it was almost as black as night. Dana Matherson had reached out and snagged Roy as he ran toward the gym, pulling him into the closet and slamming the door. Nimbly, Roy had squirted out of Dana's moist grasp, and now he huddled on the cluttered floor while Dana stumbled around, punching blindly. Scooting on the seat of his pants, Roy made his way toward a paper-thin stripe of light that he assumed was shining through a crack beneath the door. From somewhere above came a bang and then a pained yelp. Apparently, Dana had delivered a ferocious uppercut to an aluminum bucket. Somehow, Roy located the doorknob in the darkness. He flung open the door and lunged for freedom. Only his head made it into the hallway before Dana caught him. Roy's fingertips squeaked across the linoleum as he was pulled backward, and again the door closed on his shouts for help. As Dana yanked him off the floor, Roy desperately groped for something with which to defend himself. His right hand found what felt like a wooden broom handle.
"I got you now, cowgirl," Dana whispered hoarsely.
He locked Roy in a fierce bear hug that emptied the air from Roy's lungs like an accordion. His arms were pinned to his sides, and his legs dangled as limply as a rag doll's.
"Now, aren't you sorry you messed with me?" Dana gloated.
As Roy grew dizzy, the broom handle dropped from his fingers, and his ears filled with the sound of crashing waves. Dana's clench was smothering, but Roy found he could still move his lower legs. With all his unsapped strength, he started thrashing both feet. For a moment, nothing happened. Then Roy felt himself falling. He landed face up, so that his backpack absorbed the impact. It was still too dark to see, but Roy surmised from Dana's whimpering gasps that he had been kicked in a very sensitive part of his body. Roy knew he had to move swiftly. He tried to roll over, but he was weak and breathless from Dana's brutish hug. He lay there helplessly, like a turtle that had been flipped on its back. When he heard Dana bellow, Roy closed his eyes and girded himself for the worst. Dana fell heavily upon him, clamping his meaty paws around Roy's throat. "This is it," Roy thought. "The dumb goon is really going to kill me." Roy felt hot tears rolling down his cheeks. "Sorry, Mom. Maybe you and Dad can try again." Suddenly, the door of the utility closet flew open, and the weight on Roy's chest seemed to vaporize. He opened his eyes just as Dana Matherson was being lifted away, arms flailing, a stunned expression on his pug face. Roy remained on the floor, catching his breath, and trying to sort out what had just happened. Maybe Mr. Ryan had overheard the sounds of the struggle. He was plenty strong enough to hoist Dana like a bale of alfalfa. Eventually, Roy flopped over and got to his feet. He fumbled for the light switch and rearmed himself with the broom handle, just in case. When he poked his head out of the closet, he saw that the hallway was deserted. Roy dropped the broom handle and streaked for the nearest exit. He almost made it, too. 10.
I missed my bus, Roy muttered. Big deal, I'm missing soccer practice, said Beatrice.
What about Dana?
He'll live. It wasn't Mr. Ryan who saved Roy from a whooping in the closet. It was Beatrice Leap. She had left Dana Matherson stripped down to his underpants and trussed to the flagpole in front of the administration building at Trace Middle School. There, Beatrice had borrowed a bicycle, forcefully installed Roy on the handlebars, and was now churning at a manic pace toward an unknown destination. Roy wondered if this was a kidnapping in the legal sense of the term. Surely there must be a law against one kid snatching another kid from school property. Where are we going? He expected Beatrice to ignore the question, as she had twice before. But this time she answered, Your house.
What?
Just be quiet, okay? I'm in no mood, cowgirl. Roy could tell by her tone of voice that she was upset.
I need a favor, she told him, right away.
Sure, anything you want. What else could he say? He was hanging on for dear life as Beatrice zigged across busy intersections and zagged through lines of traffic. She was a skilled bicyclist, but Roy was nervous nonetheless.
Bandages, tape, goop to stop infections, Beatrice was saying. Your mom got any of that stuff?
Of course. Roy's mother kept enough medical supplies to run a mini emergency room.
Good deal. Now all we'll need is a cover story.
What's going on? Why can't you get bandages at your house?
Because it's none of your business.
Beatrice set her jaw and pedaled faster. Roy got a queasy feeling that something bad must have happened to Beatrice's stepbrother, the running boy. Mrs. Eberhardt greeted them at the front door.
I was getting worried, honey. Was the bus late? Oh, who's this?
Mom, this is Beatrice. She gave me a lift home.
I'm very pleased to meet you, Beatrice.
Roy's mother wasn't just being polite. She was plainly delighted that Roy had brought home a friend, even if it was a tough-looking girl.
We're going to Beatrice's and finish up some homework. Is that okay?
You're welcome to stay here and work. The house is quiet.
It's a science experiment, Beatrice cut in. It might get pretty messy.
Roy suppressed a smile. Beatrice had sized up his mother perfectly. Mrs. Eberhardt kept an exceptionally neat house. Her brow furrowed at the thought of glass beakers bubbling with potent chemicals.
Is it safe? She asked.
Oh, we always wear rubber gloves, Beatrice said reassuringly. And eye goggles, too. It was obvious to Roy that Beatrice was experienced at fibbing to grown-ups. Mrs. Eberhardt fell for the whole yarn. While she fixed them a snack, Roy slipped out of the kitchen and darted to his parents' bathroom. The first aid stash was in the cabinet beneath the sink. Roy removed a box of gauze, a roll of white adhesive tape, and a tube of antibiotic ointment that looked like barbecue sauce. These items he concealed in his backpack. When he returned to the kitchen, Beatrice and his mother were chatting at the table, a plate of peanut butter cookies between them. Beatrice's cheeks were full, which Roy took as a promising sign. Enticed by the sweet, warm smell, he reached across and grabbed two cookies off the top of the pile.
Let's go, Beatrice said, jumping up from her chair. We've got lots of work to do.
I'm ready, said Roy.
Oh, wait, you know what we forgot?
He had no clue what Beatrice was talking about.
No, what did we forget?
The ground beef, she said. You know, for the experiment.
Yeah, said Roy, playing along.
That's right.
Immediately his mother piped up.
Honey, I've got 2 pounds in the fridge. How much do you need?
Roy looked at Beatrice, who smiled innocently.
2 pounds would be plenty, Mrs. Eberhardt. Thanks.
Roy's mother bustled to the refrigerator and retrieved the package of meat.
What kind of science experiment is this, anyway? She asked.
Before Roy could answer, Beatrice said,
Cell decay.
Mrs. Eberhardt's nose crinkled, as if she could already smell something rotting.
You two better run along, she said, while that hamburger's still fresh.
Beatrice Leap lived with her father,
a former professional basketball player with gimpy knees, a beer gut, and not much enthusiasm for steady work. Leon Lurch Leap had been a high-scoring point guard for the Cleveland Cavaliers and later for the Miami Heat, but 12 years after retiring from the NBA, he still hadn't decided what to do with the rest of his life. Beatrice's mother was not an impatient woman, but she had eventually divorced Leon to pursue her own career as a cockatoo trainer at Parrot Jungle, a tourist attraction in Miami. Beatrice had chosen to remain with her father, partly because she was allergic to parrots, and partly because she doubted that Leon Leap could survive on his own. He had basically turned into a lump. Yet, less than 2 years after Mrs. Leap left him, Leon surprised everyone by getting engaged to a woman he met at a celebrity pro-am golf tournament. Lana was one of the waitresses in a bathing suit who drove electric carts around the golf course, serving beer and other beverages to the players. Beatrice didn't even learn Lana's last name until the day of the wedding. It was the same day Beatrice found out she was going to have a stepbrother. Lana arrived at the church towing a somber, bony-shouldered boy with sun-bleached hair and a deep tan. He looked miserable in a coat and necktie, and he didn't hang around for the reception. No sooner had Leon placed the wedding ring on Lana's finger than the boy kicked off his shiny black shoes and ran away. This was to become a recurring scene in the Leap family chronicles. Lana didn't get along with her son and nagged at him constantly. To Beatrice, it appeared as if Lana was afraid that the boy's quirky behavior might annoy her new husband, though Leon Leap seemed not to notice. Occasionally, he'd make a half-hearted attempt to bond with the kid, but the two had little in common. The boy held no interest in Leon's prime passions, sports, junk food, and cable television, and spent all his free time roaming the woods and swamps. As for Leon, he wasn't much of an outdoorsman, and was leery of any critter that wasn't wearing a collar and a rabies tag. One night, Lana's son brought home an orphan baby raccoon, which promptly crawled into one of Leon's favorite moleskin slippers and relieved itself. Leon seemed more puzzled than upset, but Lana went totally ballistic. Without consulting her husband, she arranged for her son to be shipped off to a military prep school, the first of several failed attempts to normalize the boy. He seldom lasted more than 2 weeks before running away or being expelled. The last time it happened, Lana purposely didn't tell Leon. Instead, she continued to pretend that her son was doing fine, that his grades were good and his conduct was improving. The truth was, Lana didn't know where the boy had gone and didn't intend to go looking for him. She was fed up with the little monster, or so Beatrice overheard her say on the telephone. As for Leon Leap, he displayed no curiosity beyond what his wife had told him about her wayward offspring. Leon didn't even notice when the tuition bills from the military school stopped coming. Long before his mother sent him away for the last time, the boy and his stepsister had forged a quiet alliance. After Lana's son made his way back to Coconut Cove, the first and only person he contacted was Beatrice. She agreed to keep his whereabouts a secret, knowing that Lana would call the juvenile authorities if she ever found out. That concern was what had prompted Beatrice Leap to confront Roy Eberhardt after she saw him chasing her stepbrother that first day. She did what any big sister would have done. On the bicycle ride, Beatrice shared enough bits and pieces of her family story with Roy that he understood the difficult situation. And after seeing her stepbrother's wounds, he knew why Beatrice had run for help after she found him moaning inside the old JoJo's ice cream truck. It was the first time Roy had been permitted to see the running boy up close and face to face. The kid was stretched out, a crumpled cardboard box serving as a pillow. His straw blonde hair was matted from perspiration, and his forehead felt hot to the touch. In the boy's eyes was a restless, darting animal flicker that Roy had seen before. "Does it hurt bad?" Roy asked. "Nope." "Liar," Beatrice said. The boy's left arm was purple and swollen. At first, Roy thought it was from a snake bite and worriedly glanced around. Fortunately, the bag of cottonmouths was nowhere in sight. "I stopped by on the way to the bus stop this morning and found him like this," Beatrice explained to Roy. Then to her stepbrother, "Go on, tell cowgirl what happened." "Dog got me." The boy turned his arm over and pointed to several angry red holes in the skin. The bites were nasty, but Roy had seen worse. One time, his father had taken him to a state fair where a rodeo clown got chomped by a panicky horse. The clown was bleeding so badly that he was rushed to the hospital in a helicopter. Roy unzipped his backpack and removed the medical supplies. He knew a little about treating puncture wounds from a first aid course he'd taken at summer camp in Bozeman. Beatrice had already cleansed her stepbrother's arm with soda water, so Roy lathered antibiotic ointment on a panel of gauze and taped it firmly around the boy's arm. "You need a tetanus shot," Roy said. Mulletfinger shook his head. "I'll be okay. Is the dog still running around here?" The boy turned inquiringly to Beatrice, who said, "Go ahead and tell him." "You sure?" "Yeah, he's all right." She shot an appraising glance at Roy. "Besides, he owes me. He almost got squashed in a closet today. Isn't that right, cowgirl?" Roy's cheeks flushed. "Never mind that. What about this dog?" "Actually, there was four of them," Mulletfinger said, "behind a chain fence." "So how'd you get bit?" Roy asked. "Arm got stuck." "Doing what?" "It's no big deal," said the boy. "Beatrice, did you get some hamburger?" "Yeah, Roy's mom gave it to us." The kid sat up. "Then we better roll." Roy said, "No, you need to rest." "Later, come on, they'll be getting hungry soon." Roy looked at Beatrice Leap, who offered no explanation. They followed Mulletfingers down the steps of the ice cream truck and out of the junkyard. "Meet you there," he said, and broke into a full run. Roy couldn't imagine the strength it must have taken, considering his painful injury. As Mulletfingers scampered off, Roy noticed with some satisfaction that he was wearing shoes, the same sneakers Roy had brought for him a few days earlier. Beatrice mounted the bicycle and pointed at the handlebars. "Hop aboard." "No way," Roy said. "Don't be a wuss. Hey, I don't want any part of this. Not if he's going to hurt those dogs." "What are you talking about? That's why he wanted the meat, right?" Roy thought he'd figured it out. He thought the kid meant to take revenge on the dogs by spiking the hamburger with something harmful, maybe even poisonous. Beatrice laughed and rolled her eyes. "He's not that kind of crazy. Now let's go." 15 minutes later, Roy found himself on East Oriole Avenue, at the same trailer where the foreman had hollered at him a few days before. It was nearly 5 o'clock, and the construction site looked deserted. Roy noticed that a chain-link fence had been erected to enclose the lot. He recalled that the cranky foreman had threatened to unleash vicious guard dogs, and he assumed they were the ones that bit Mulletfingers. Jumping off the bike, Roy said to Beatrice, "Does this have anything to do with that cop car that got spray-painted?" Beatrice said nothing. "Or the gators and the portable potties?" Roy asked. He knew the answer, but Beatrice's expression said it all. "Mind your own business." Despite the fever and the raging infection, her stepbrother had beaten them to the Pancake House construction site. "Let me have that," he said, snatching the package of meat from Roy's hands. Roy grabbed it back. "Not till you tell me what for." The kid looked to Beatrice for assistance, but she shook her head. "Get it over with," she told him. "Come on, we haven't got all day." His injured arm hanging limply, Mulletfingers clambered up one side of the fence and down the other. Beatrice followed, effortlessly swinging her long legs over the top. "What are you waiting for?" she barked at Roy, still standing on the other side. "What about those dogs?" "The dogs," said Mulletfingers, "are long gone." More confused than ever, Roy scaled the fence. He followed Beatrice and her stepbrother to a parked bulldozer. They huddled in the shaded cup of the blade, safely out of sight from the road. Roy sat in the middle position, with Beatrice on his left side and Mulletfingers on his right. Roy held the package of meat on his lap, covering it with both arms like a fullback protecting a football. "Did you paint that cop car?" he bluntly asked the boy. "No comment." "And hide those alligators in the toilets?" Mulletfingers stared straight ahead, his eyes narrowing. "I don't get it," Roy said. "Why would you try crazy stuff like that? Who cares if they build a stupid pancake house here?" The boy's head snapped around, and he froze Roy with a cold look. Beatrice spoke up. "My stepbrother got bit by the dogs because his arm got stuck when he reached through the fence. Now, ask me why he was reaching through the fence." "Okay, why?" Roy said.
He was putting out snakes. The same snakes from the golf course? The cottonmouths? Roy exclaimed. But why? You trying to kill somebody?
Mullet Fingers smiled knowingly. They couldn't hurt a flea, them snakes. I taped their mouths shut.
I'm so sure, Roy said.
Plus, I glued sparkles on their tails, the boy added, so they'd be easy to spot.
Beatrice said, He's telling the truth, Eberhardt.
Indeed, Roy had seen the sparkling tails for himself.
But come on, he said. How do you tape a snake's mouth closed?
Real carefully, said Beatrice with a dry laugh.
Oh, it ain't so hard, Mullet Fingers added. If you know what you're doing. See, I wasn't trying to hurt them dogs. Just rile them up.
Dogs do not like snakes, Beatrice explained.
Makes them freak out, bark and howl and run around in circles, her stepbrother said. I knew the trainer would drag him out of here as soon as he saw the cottonmouths. Those Rottweilers ain't cheap.
It was the wildest plan Roy had ever heard.
The only part I didn't count on, said Mullet Fingers, eyeing his bandaged arm, was getting bit.
Roy said, I'm almost afraid to ask, but what happened to your snakes?
Oh, they're fine, the boy reported. I came back and got them all. Took them to a safe place and let them go free.
But first he had to peel the tape off their mouths, said Beatrice, chuckling.
Stop! Roy was completely exasperated.
Hold on right there.
Mullet Fingers and Beatrice looked at him matter-of-factly. Roy's head was spinning with questions. These kids must be from another world.
Would one of you please tell me, he begged, what's all this got to do with pancakes? Maybe I'm dense, but I really don't get it.
Grimacing, the boy rubbed his bloated arm.
It's simple, man, he said to Roy.
They can't put a Mother Paula's here for the same reason they can't have big old nasty Rottweilers running loose.
Show him why, Beatrice said to her stepbrother.
Okay, give me the hamburger.
Roy handed over the package. Mullet Fingers peeled off the plastic wrapper and scooped out a handful of ground beef, which he carefully rolled into 6 perfect little meatballs.
Follow me, he said, but try and be quiet.
The boy led Roy to a hole in a grassy patch of ground. At the entrance of the hole, Mullet Fingers placed 2 hamburger balls. Next, he walked to an identical-looking hole on the other side of the lot and left 2 more meatballs there. He followed the same ritual at another hole in a far corner of the property. Peeking into one of the dark tunnels, Roy asked, What's down there? In Montana, the only animals that dug holes like that were gophers and badgers, and Roy was positive there weren't many of those in Florida.
Hush, the boy said.
Roy trailed him back to the bulldozer, where Beatrice remained perched on the blade, cleaning her eyeglasses.
Well? She said to Roy.
Well, what?
Mullet Fingers tapped him on the arm.
Listen.
Roy heard a short, high-pitched, coo, coo.
Then, from across the open lot, came another. Beatrice's stepbrother rose stealthily, tugged off his new sneakers, and crept forward. Roy followed closely. The boy was grinning through his fever when he signaled for them to stop.
Look!
He pointed toward the first burrow.
Wow! Roy said under his breath.
There, standing by the hole and peering curiously at one of the meatballs, was the smallest owl that he had ever seen.
Mullet Fingers chucked him gently on the shoulder. Okay, now do you get it?
Yeah, said Roy. I get it.
11. Officer David Delinko had made a habit of driving past the construction site every morning on the way to the police station, and again every afternoon on his way home. Sometimes he even cruised by late at night if he went out for a snack. Conveniently, there was a mini-mart only a few blocks away. So far, the policeman hadn't seen much out of the ordinary, except for the scene earlier that day, a wild-eyed man waving a red umbrella and chasing several giant black dogs around the property. The foreman of the Mother Paula's project had said it was a canine training exercise, nothing to be alarmed about. Officer Delinko had no reason to doubt it. Even though he'd hoped to capture the vandals himself, the policeman agreed it was an excellent idea for the Pancake House Company to put up a fence and post some guard dogs. Surely that would scare off potential intruders.
That afternoon, after another 8 dull hours of desk duty, Officer Delenko decided to swing by the Mother Paula's site once more. 2 hours of daylight remained, and he was eager to see those attack dogs in action. He got there expecting a mad chorus of barking, but the place was strangely silent. No